From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Also in studio with us is Brian Frosch. He is Maryland's Attorney General. Brian Frosch, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
If you have questions or comments for the Attorney General, start calling now at 800-433-8850. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of the broadcast, ask a question or make a comment. That's kojoshow.org. You can send us a tweet at kojoshow or email to kojo@wamu.org. Tom Sherwood, last week when we had the Maryland Senate President Mike Miller on this show, he mentioned that he knew Governor Larry Hogan since he was 5 years old, and that's because he knew the governor's father. Well, the governor's father, Lawrence J. Hogan Sr., died during the course of this past week. He was a well-known Prince George's County politician who rose to national prominence at some point. He was often described as combative, but I am sure that a lot of people who knew and worked with him will miss him dearly. Did you know him, Brian Frosch, at all?
I shook his hand. I did not know him personally.
Okay. Tom Sherwood, you had any experience with the senior, Hogan?
Well, you know, I have some vague recollection, you know, but I couldn't place a story to tell you, except that, you know, Mr. Hogan Sr., his name came up, you know, last year because the current governor of the state of Maryland, Larry Hogan, was asked, you know, was badgered about why he wasn't supporting Donald Trump. And, of course, Governor Hogan said he had written in his father.
His father's name.
So that was a nice thing. But you know, Senior Hogan had been a Kennedy Democrat who, during the 1960 election, switched to Richard Nixon, and then, to surprise everyone after that, he also was the first Republican who stood up in the Congress and said that then President Nixon should be impeached. He was a true political character.
Indeed. And he will.
And of course, you know some things. You know, he was opposing busing. He was there in Prince George's County. If it's going through its demographic shift,
yep.
He was on the conservative white male side of that. But those who knew him said that there was a great deal of good in him, even though his politics were quite conservative.
And the other thing that you should know is of interest to Tom Sherwood today.
Absolutely. I know what this is about.
The White House has permanently closed the sidewalk on the south side of the White House in front of the fence. And Tom Sherwood has been carping for years about how we are being walled out of all of our public institutions in this town. And this, I guess, in your view, Tom, just takes it one step farther.
It may be just a little sidewalk on the south side of the White House on East Street, which used to be a street in the American commerce system, but was closed for security reasons and now is a parking lot for security vehicles. But this is the little sidewalk on the south side where tourists from all over the world come and want to stick their little cameras and iPhones up and take a picture of the White House from the mall side. And it was closed from 11 o'clock at night to 6 in the morning anyway. And now the Secret Service, which can't figure out how to keep people from jumping their fences, have said that it's closed and you can't go. You know, in 1996, the America's main avenue, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, was closed by President Clinton because of the Oklahoma City bombing. As I like to say, a bomb went off in Oklahoma City and they closed our main street. And then in 2001, E Street, that street across behind the White House, was closed. And those are east-west traffic lanes for our American commerce. Surely there's a way for us to protect freedom without getting rid of it. What's that old saying? I think it's attributed to Benjamin Franklin, but it may not be his. Those who give up liberty in the search of security deserve neither.
Okay. End of rant. That took 1 minute and 30 seconds. But yes, we have to say that. The other thing that district residents and activists are talking about a great deal this week is that the chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee has indicated that not only will he be not running for re-election in Utah, he might actually leave office early. Jason Chaffetz, Utah congressman, has been a thorn in the side of district leaders and activists for the past several years. And so, Tom, I guess those activists are celebrating, but who knows what's next?
Well, that's true. I mean, there's a whole line of people who think they know how to run the district better than we do. They may have the constitutional authority to oversee the district. It doesn't mean they have to put their grubby little hands on every little local issue. And Mr. Chaffetz, you know, if they would want to come around the city and visit some of the wards and visit some of the people and come to our churches and synagogues and get to know the city and then want to inject their views, it would be fine with me. They could be part of the city. But Mr. Chaffetz, mysteriously, people think he might run for governor in 2020 in Utah. But if he leaves Congress before his term's up, that says something, just raises eyebrows and question marks of what's he really doing. You know, he tried to stop the Death with Dignity bill, the marijuana bill, several other bills. Fortunately, he wasn't very successful as a congressman doing those. But Mark Meadows and other members of the House are standing ready to take his place. I just hope they will get to know the city before they try to run the city.
Yes, indeed. If he leaves office before his term is up, people will begin to question
his
sense of civic responsibility. As we said, joining us in studio is Brian Fosh, Maryland's Attorney General. We will now turn our questions to him, and so can you. Call us at 800-433-8850. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Earlier this week, Mr. Attorney General, a conservative group said it would sue the state of Maryland unless it cleans up its voter rolls. They cited data showing that there are more registered voters in Montgomery County than there are citizens of voting age. And that is, according to them, strong circumstantial evidence that the state's rolls include people who should not be there. The group Judicial Watch has made several similar allegations around the country. If the Board of Elections does not comply, would they have a case?
No. Highly unlikely. These Inspector Clouseau-like organizations are I think, really engaged in the business of voter suppression, Judicial Watch. Montgomery County complies, as far as we know, with all of the national and state requirements for purging the voter rolls. I think these guys have failed to take into account the fact that 16-year-olds are allowed and, in fact, encouraged to register to vote in the state of Maryland. And they don't get to vote until they turn 18, but they're on the rolls. So,
unless they're in Tacoma Park, I think.
Well, they don't get to vote for state offices or federal offices, but they can vote for local offices. So, you know, I'm not sure their math is that good. And the officials at the state level and at the county level say that Montgomery County is complying with the law.
The State Board of Elections met last night and sent us an email this morning saying the State Board did not make any decisions about the voter rolls in Montgomery County or responding to the allegations about voter rolls. They discussed the letter, received public comment, and will await the results of our review of the letter.
Is there some state law or the voter registration rolls? And I thought we used to have routine purges that if you didn't vote in three successive elections in various jurisdictions,
right,
your name would be taken off. But then people say, well, wait, that doesn't disqualify you if you don't vote. That's one way of voting, is to say, I'm not going to vote. So is there some required purging of the voter roll?
There are federal laws that require purging of the voter rolls. And my understanding is that Montgomery County complies with those, as do other jurisdictions in the state.
I know in the district there's some people who are looking at the voter registration rolls. So we have a huge registration list, 400-something-odd thousand registered Democrats, let alone our handful of Republicans, 37,000. But, you know, we only have 680,000 people in the city, so we'll have to take a look at it.
Yeah.
Maryland's Democratic lawmakers this session expanded your authority. It's my understanding that Maryland's Attorney General has traditionally had less power than many of your counterparts. Why did they do this, and what new authority do you have with the laws that were passed this session?
So the General Assembly passed legislation that gives our office the right and the authority to stand up for Maryland citizens if their life, health, welfare is threatened by federal action or inaction. In short, they gave us the authority to sue the federal government, and you you can run down the laundry list of campaign threats or promises, depending on your perspective, that the president made and has taken some steps toward carrying out. The Muslim ban was one. And in fact, we did sue the Trump administration over the Muslim ban. We joined the state of Washington and a number of other jurisdictions in that. President Trump said when he was campaigning that he was going to eliminate gun-free school zones. He was going to eliminate the bans on assault weapons. He was going to repeal the Affordable Care Act, upon which more than 400,000 Marylanders depend for health care. And, you know, a long list of other promises that he made that would, I think, do real harm to our state and our citizens.
Well, you'll be running afoul of the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, you know, who got some attention this week, I'll say, when he referred to a judge in a little island in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah, he
forgot how to tell the president essentially what to do. Are the state attorneys general, of not you, but Carl Racine in the district, others, or Mark Herring in Virginia, they're saying we're going to stand up to all of these things because they can't just run roughshod over the law.
Right. I mean, it's outrageous for the Attorney General of the United States, first, to disrespect a United States District Court judge, but second, to forget that Hawaii is a state.
I'd like to point out that I was living in Hawaii in 1959 when it became a state.
Wow.
I was an Army brat.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Well, new information.
I could never learn to surf, but that's a whole different story.
Actually, he was expelled from Hawaii, but that's another story. Brian Foss, you can now sue drug makers over things like price increases. When might that come up? Would this be in cases, for example, like the spike in the cost of the EpiPen?
Could be, Kojo. We've seen nationally and in Maryland, of course, the prices of generic drugs skyrocket. It's hard to understand because generic drugs and off-patent brand drugs are not protected by patents. Usually the price of a branded drug will drop by as much as 80% if there's robust competition after it comes off patent. And despite that, what the Government Accountability Office found, it looked at a basket of 1,400 generic drugs and found that more than 300 of them had experienced what it called extraordinary price increases in a relatively short period of time. They used that term extraordinary for price increases that exceed 100%. There was a study by the U.S. Senate Committee on Aging looking at a series of off-patent branded drugs and generic drugs. The poster child for them is Daraprim. It's the one where the price of one pill went from $13.50 to $750. And those are the kinds of cases that the General Assembly gave our office the authority to look at.
It's not called Big Pharma for a reason. You know,
well,
it is called Big Pharma for a reason.
It is.
But what is the solution to that? I mean, you're correct. When you go to a generic drug, generally the price drops precipitously.
Right.
Because the pharma has to make money for the research it does, the lengthy and expensive research it does. But this country seems to stand alone politically in how drugs are sold, whether you just go across to Canada or to Europe. We just pay an extraordinary amount. I just anecdotally went to get an allergy medicine this past week, and it was one bottle of a spray. It was about $300, and I just simply said I'd rather sneeze.
Right. Yes, we do pay higher prices than they do in Europe and in Canada for the same drugs. And it looks like in the generic market there have been some companies who've been able to corner. Daraprim treats toxoplasmosis.
Oh, goodness.
If you've got that, you're in bad shape. And they basically have a gun to your head. They're the only ones who make it. And somehow the markets have been distorted, and prices have gone out of control.
Our guest is Brian Frosch. He's Maryland's Attorney General. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Christian Dorsey. He's an Arlington County board member and a member of the Metro Board. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. If you've got questions for the Attorney General, call now at 800-433-8850. If you have called already, hold on for 1 second. I just want to ask the Attorney General one more question, and we will get to the phones. You can also send email to kojo@wmu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. With Republicans in the White House and the Governor's Mansion, the Baltimore Sun described you as a kind of night watchman for Maryland's Democratic state lawmakers as they start their nine-month recess until the next General Assembly session. But I checked. In 2004, there was a Republican in the White House, George W. Bush. Dennis Hastert headed up the Congress. He was the Speaker. And the President of the Senate was Dick Cheney. They didn't take that action then. Why now?
Well, I think we're at a unique period in American history. I think we have a president who does not show respect for the rule of law. He has acted precipitously. He's threatened to act in ways that are illegal, unconstitutional. The Muslim ban was unconstitutional. And the General Assembly felt that in those circumstances, it was appropriate to give the Attorney General of Maryland the power to stand up for Maryland citizens. I should say that most other attorneys general have those powers already. 41 other attorneys general have what are called common law powers and don't need the governor's approval to bring suit to protect their citizens.
So it's putting you in line with a number of other attorney generals, right?
Have you announced for re-election yet?
I have not.
When is that going to happen? Before the end of this year?
Don't have a schedule yet.
Let's we'll go to the phones.
Because Tom would really like to press you on this issue. Here is Will in Washington, D.C. Will, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much, Kojo, and thanks to General Frosch for taking my question. I'm a graduate student at the University of Maryland, graduate employee at the University of Maryland, and Attorney General Frosch, as you know from your time in the Senate, we have been seeking the right to collectively bargain for a number of years. Back in August, the National Labor Relations Board ruled that all student employees at private colleges around the country have the right to collectively bargain, and some of the graduate and student employees in our region have begun to unionized through that. I'm curious if you think there's grounds in Maryland state law to consider student employees, as employees.
Indeed, we got a tweet from Yvonne in Maryland. Maryland law does not recognize University of Maryland graduate student workers as employees. Please ask Mr. Frosch what his legal opinion is on this matter.
It's like a campaign.
I'm sad to say I can't give legal opinions over the air. We do a little more research and consideration than I'm able to do sitting here right now. I can say that when I was a member of the General Assembly, I thought it was a good idea, but that's completely different from what the advice and opinion of the Office of the Attorney General might be on the subject.
Tom?
Last week I was up in Frederick with Peter Franchot, complaining about what the legislature did to the beer laws in the state, giving, on the one hand, the growing craft industry a chance to sell more directly to the consumer, although with some wholesale, some say foolishness thrown in. And he said that he wants to rewrite all of the Maryland state laws on beer so that they will fit on a cocktail napkin. Have you delved into this? You know, craft beer industry, it's a big growing industry in North Carolina, D.C., other places are really doing a lot. Mr. Franchot, the tax collector, says Maryland is undercutting this growing industry.
You know, we have what they call in Maryland a three-tier system. I never thought it was a particularly useful system, except for the folks who sell alcohol. It means that essentially there are three bites taken out of the consumer every time some kind of alcohol, beer, wine, or otherwise is made and sold. There is a volume of the Maryland annotated code directed toward alcoholic beverages, and it certainly could be streamlined and reduced. Not sure we still need the three-tier system, and if it's going to be revised, perhaps it shouldn't just be the craft beer industry that is the subject of the revision. They ought to look at it across the board.
Would you get involved in something like that, or would that purely be a legislative matter?
It's mostly a legislative matter. They'd ask our advice, but most of the issues are policy issues.
You are running for re-election, or you just haven't? It's like Mayor Bowser said.
I have not announced that I'm running for re-election. Right, I'm certainly out there talking to folks, and
he's running.
Okay, talking to folks. You know, once they say we're talking to folks,
occasionally raising money.
A few people have been asking me to make sure I know these answers. I just wanted to. I'm surprised people don't just do it earlier.
Here is Len in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Len, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kodjo. I always appreciate being able to speak up here on your program. I had a question for the Attorney General connected to his earlier criticism, which I agree with, of Attorney General Sessions' remark about a district federal judge. In this case, it involved Governor Hogan himself, who earlier this week made some false accusations against a federal district judge, Judge Leon, who is looking at the case of the Purple Line, claiming that Judge Leon lived in a country club by the Purple Line and that his wife was an activist against it. Both of these are false. As far as I know, the governor's office has not corrected the record or apologized.
Yes, in fact, the governor's office later issued an email saying that the governor was referring to the fact that the judge lives across the street from Martin Weingand, who served as the club's president for 2 years, and that the judge was an avid golfer. But the fact also is that Columbia Country Club had fought against the construction of the Purple Line, but it dropped its opposition to the project in 2013 after reaching an agreement with state officials to shift the path of the tracks. But care to comment at all, Brian Frost?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I strongly support the Purple Line. Our office is pressing the case or defending the case in federal court, and I don't think it is appropriate to talk about it. No conflict of interest claim assertion of any kind has been made in court, and I think it's important to respect the judiciary and Judge Lee, and I hope will.
Our caller wants you to comment on whether or not Governor Hogan was using alternative facts.
I can't. You know as much about the facts of that as I do. I don't know facts that support the straight up claim that his wife is somehow involved.
These allegations were made last fall. I mean, there were on listservs in different places. You heard these, but there was no there that tied any specific action. That they just disagree with the decision. So, but it seems to me we're in a period of time, historic period of time, where everybody, and maybe the social media is driving this, where everyone is under assault of some kind all the time.
They are, and it's dangerous when the integrity of our judiciary is questioned on a routine basis.
The Maryland House decided not to vote on the cash bail bill, disappointing the bail bonds industry that had weighed in heavily on it. Fighting against that legislation has been a big focus for your office. What would that legislation have done? What are the legal issues as you see it?
So, Kodjo, we have had a problem in Maryland for many years, and that is that we have people in jail for one reason, because they're poor. We worked very hard with the judiciary and with the Rules Committee that advises it to change that, and they did. The Maryland Court of Appeals adopted unanimously a rule that makes it clear that any judge who sets a financial condition for somebody who's been charged with a crime must ensure that the person isn't going to be in jail because he or she is poor. The rule is a very important step forward, not just because it brings Maryland into compliance with the United States Constitution, but because it's a terrible policy that that puts people in jail just for poverty.
And then they can't do anything to address the issues that they have any judgments against them. They can't do anything to earn money to do it because they're in jail.
Absolutely. I mean, people lose their jobs, they lose their homes, they lose their families. It's incredibly destructive, and it costs us as taxpayers. It costs $100, $150 a day for us to house them in jail. So there was a bill that was designed to overturn that rule. It shifted shape, changed language. It was improved as it went through the process, but it still was not as good as the rule, and still was designed to shift back toward a money bail first priority. And we thought the bill was harmful. The rule is extremely important, and we were gratified that the bill was not passed.
We got an email from Cole. Cole writes, you said you're going to stand up for the constitutional rights of Marylanders, but the General Assembly, Senator Madaleno, has said that giving the Attorney General the right to defend the Second Amendment would be in conflict with Maryland's current gun laws. Where do Maryland's gun laws stand in the courts?
Well, we passed a law in 2013, the Firearm Safety Act, that did a number of different things, all directed toward public safety, all make Marylanders safer. One of the main provisions was one which bans the sale of assault weapons in our state. That's been challenged. It's in court. We won in the federal district court, reversed by a panel of the Fourth Circuit, and then won again with the full Fourth Circuit considering that. They said that Maryland's assault weapons ban is constitutional. That is likely to be the subject of review by the Supreme Court, or the plaintiffs are likely to seek review by the Supreme Court on that. So we're defending Maryland's law in that case. Other aspects of the law have been challenged as well. None of the provisions of the Firearm Safety Act, the ones that require a license to purchase a handgun, none of those have been overturned. We expect them all to be upheld, and we will defend them vigorously.
I want to ask about marijuana. The legislature got flummoxed over what to do about medical marijuana, but I also read that the Maryland State Police Commission, I think that's what it's called, set standards for police officers, has changed its rule on whether you've smoked pot in the past. Are you up to speed on this? We had 420 this week, so that's which is a code word for smoking marijuana.
So, yes, the police commission previously had a rule that said if you had smoked marijuana more than a certain number of times.
20 times in your life.
In your life or some.
I'm not sure anybody I know who smokes marijuana would be able to keep track of the times they'd smoked. And the other one was you could not have smoked it more than 5 times since you were 21.
Right.
Adam Eidinger begs to differ. The stoners are very good at accounting, but go ahead.
Well, that's if somebody's doing it for them. And but now the new rule, I just found this kind of bureaucratically funny. It says that you can be a police officer if you have not ingested or smoked, whatever Bill Clinton might say about it, pot in 3 years, marijuana in 3 years. How the hell would anybody know? You could just say, I didn't.
Well,
I mean, these things are just ridiculous rules.
Is there a three-year test?
I mean, how would you know?
Apparently there is now. How would you know?
I didn't smoke marijuana in 3 years. I want to be a police officer. How would you know if I'm lying or telling the truth?
Well, I think the individual who says I haven't smoked in 3 years would know. So
it would be a lie if it weren't true.
But I have no idea.
Do they do a lie detector test?
They do lie detector tests for police officers.
I'll never be a police officer.
They'll find a good friend who will say, we smoked marijuana together a year and a half ago, so he's lying in this
situation. It was 420 this week. That's the code word for smoking marijuana.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to get in Steve in Baltimore, Maryland. Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Attorney General Frosch, I'm curious if you could comment on the lawsuit that was filed back in December against NMS Healthcare.
Yes, I can tell you about the allegations in that suit.
Yes.
NMS is a nursing home chain. We allege in that complaint that they have thrown people out of their nursing homes illegally. They have issued more eviction notices than all of the other nursing homes in the state combined. They represent 2% of the beds and have something like 70% of the nursing home evictions. And we allege in the complaint that they do it because they don't want to accept Medicaid payments. They're happy to get Medicare payments, which are about twice as much as Medicaid payments. But when somebody loses their Medicare eligibility and shifts to Medicaid eligibility, as a business matter, we allege they're trying to force them out.
So thank you very much for your call, Steve. We are just about out of time, but we were talking earlier about the passing of Governor Larry Hogan's father when we got this email from Leslie. Please mention that last night Adventure Theater awarded its first Judy Frosch Spirit of Adventure Award to Maryland First Lady Yumi Hogan in honor of Brian's late mother, Judy, who founded Adventure Theater, now in its 65th year, producing professional theater for children at Glen Echo Park and classes for children. Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Glen Echo Park is a great place to take your kids. There are all kinds of adventure theater things going on there. My granddaughter loves it.
Excellent. Can we, this is going to end on a positive. Can I ask about I-270 and traffic? He goes to
Final question.
He goes to Baltimore every day, except for when he comes to this show. I mean,
I'm against it, Tom.
You're against I-270?
I'm against the traffic on I-270.
I think we should.
Who's for it?
Anyway, I won't ask about it. I went on 270. I was stuck in a horrible traffic jam, but I won't rant about it.
That's the normal state of 270. Brian Frosch is Maryland's Attorney General. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Coming up, Christian Dorsey. He's an Arlington County board member and a Metro board member. You can start with your questions for him at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. You mentioned yesterday was 420. Well, you should know that pot activists, led once again by the aforementioned Adam Eidinger, co-founder of the group advocacy group DCMJ, will be lighting up at the Capitol Monday at high noon on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, where they are likely to be arrested. But Adam Eidinger says he's prepared for that. But the whole point of it is to push Congress to allow the District of Columbia to regulate marijuana, which the citizens have voted to legalize.
I thought there were arrests yesterday on the Hill. They're going to try to smoke marijuana every couple of days on the Hill?
So it would appear. Yesterday was at 4:20 p.m., but right, apparently there's something else scheduled for Monday at high noon.
Well, the Attorney General talked about, you know, going through historic periods of time, and I think we are going through one since the 30s when marijuana was portrayed as something that would make everyone crazy. We've by way of medical marijuana, have moved into where it can be a useful thing. And then the district, of course, is now on a recreational basis, as other states are. Colorado is selling it, making hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. The liquor alcohol industry doesn't particularly like it. But I think we're seeing a progressive change to where marijuana will come out from behind the barriers. And it'll be part of American life. It'll just be a lot faster than people are expecting.
Joining us in studio now is Christian Dorsey. He's an Arlington County board member and a Metro board member. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Good to be with you and Tom.
If you have questions or comments, hit us at 800-433-8850. Does it excite you that a Democrat was able to win the race for Prince William County Clerk of Court?
The Clerk of Court, yes. It's not a well-known race, but it's somewhat surprising that we have a Democrat, someone who had run before and come up just short. But, as all elections, no matter what level, are really important these days to see what kind of a national statement they're making, it's exciting to see that a Democrat was able to prevail in a seat that is usually held by Republicans.
That's all the proof I need the Democrats are excited about. Here's an Arlington County board member who has great expertise on the race for Prince William County.
Not that far away. You know, John Whitbeck, the Republican Party chairman, says, you know, the Democrats are not smoking something, but he said that they are misguided in their thoughts that this is some kind of Democratic resurgence. But I think you've weighed in on supporting Justin Fairfax for lieutenant governor, Democratic nominee. Where are you in the race for governor?
Well, you know, I think for me personally, Ralph Northam is a great, compelling candidate. You know, someone who has really served Virginia well and has been really working hard for the nomination. You know, people look at Ralph and Tom Perriello, who's also a great candidate, and they see a striking difference in style. But I'm really kind of focused on the substance, and while that's not to say that Mr. Perriello doesn't have substance, I've just really been impressed with Ralph Northam and think that the clarity of his conviction is going to serve as well.
And those issues of the NRA giving Mr. Perello an A-plus rating when he was in Congress. It hurts him in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think it does to a degree.
Abortion issue.
And, you know, of course, he's got the Bernie Sanders endorsement, which somewhat counterbalances that, at least for some progressives. But, you know, for me, I just have a real clarity as to what Ralph Northam is all about. And while I consider myself personally a lot more on the progressive wing, Ralph is solid in the areas that really matter. I'm with him.
I think Tom Perriello's calling you right now.
This is an ongoing issue for him. He's done very well in his campaign, although his money has come in lump sums from various people. But he's a strong, attractive type candidate. But you know, getting down to voting, you got to look at who the issues are, where the issues are.
You wear two hats. One as a Metro board member representing Arlington, and you're on the Arlington County Board. So we'd like your, regional perspective on this. Metro's general manager joined us on the show yesterday to talk about his plan to keep Metro solvent. He says Metro needs a new business plan and will require a $15 billion infusion over the next 10 years. What do you think of the plan that the general manager laid out?
Well, Kojo, let me say that, you know, any plan has elements of it that you have questions and concerns about, but the broad outlines of the plan, the clear direction that Mr. Wiedefeld has outlined, I support fully. And, you know, I think it's important to tease out what exactly on substance this plan is calling for. Cost containment on the Metro side that's backed up by a cap for the jurisdictional subsidies to increase by no more than 3% a year. That's an important shift for Metro. The call for dedicated funding, which is, you know, of course, cynics can correctly call it a new tax in order to fund Metro operations, but that it's directed towards giving not only an infusion of cash to the capital program, but to give Metro the financial wherewithal to leverage the capital markets to borrow affordably. It's a really key element. It's a way to keep things sustainable in terms of cost. He reiterates that the fare policy, that this plan is cognizant of not raising fares more than every other year, which is an important thing, that it absolutely makes clear that the federal government has to at least maintain its effort on funding our capital needs. And then finally, that Metro does something that it's never done but needs to do, develop a reserve fund so that it can deal with fluctuations without putting that all back on the jurisdiction. So broadly speaking, it's a solid plan.
As Tom Sherwood likes to say, this is the politics hour. That's all well and good. But how do you get that by elected officials in the Commonwealth of Virginia?
Yes, this is the dedicated funding is the key to the rest of the things. And you're in the state of Virginia. I mean, if I were in charge, I would just cut off Virginia. We'd have a metro system with Maryland,
Maryland,
and D.C. We might include the three stops, the rail stops in Arlington, just because y'all are basically
three. We have 11. We're
I thought
huge.
You only have three.
No,
three,
my goodness. Oh, you have 11? Roslyn, Ballston, and Crystal and Pentagon City,
well,
Crystal City Corridor.
I only think of Arlington as Roslyn. You know, but in any event, I would just cut you guys off and run the commuter trains out there during the... I talked to Jack Evans, of course. You're your good buddy, chairman of the...
Yes,
he said really nice things about you, so you could be in trouble.
Oh,
he said you've come in and you're new on the board.
Yeah.
He says you're thoughtful. You're taking a serious look at what all these things are. You're trying not to be jurisdictional. And that you're trying to say...
That doesn't get us $15 billion.
But it doesn't get you in Richmond, that General Assembly, which still just sees Northern Virginia as a cash cow
right.
for the state and doesn't want to change it.
Well, Tom, that's exactly why the General Assembly's got to get on board. Because,
who's going to make them?
But let me just explain the case that I'm going to make. So, basically, the GM's plan calls for $500 million. If you look at various ways to achieve that number, a regional sales tax of 1% that's applied in all the metro jurisdictions is going to raise at least that, probably more in the range of $650 million. That's a regional sales tax. We don't need people in Hampton Roads or Southside Virginia to pay that. We just need the authority to tax ourselves to do that, and I think we'd have the support to make that happen. And because we are the cash cow for the Commonwealth, getting Metro fixed allows that engine to keep humming, which returns way more dividends. So, you know, the case that I got to make to the General Assembly is I don't need you to do anything extra for me. Just give me the ability to do for myself. And that's going to produce incredible returns for you and the state. Now, this is the politics
hour. What is likely to be the opposition to that?
the opposition is the same old tropes of we don't want to increase taxes, blah, blah,
and
blah.
And we want to control things. If we start giving local jurisdictions power to do things, the Dillon Rule,
that's
then,
right.
we'll, then you'll come back next year and say, well, we need just a little bit more power to do this. And that, and the Richmond says no. That's why your minimum wage
are
is $7.25.
Right, absolutely.
That's why, you know, your roadways are wacky. It's because you don't count in Richmond.
That's right. And, you know, look, they in terms of the Virginia General Assembly, while, you know, Northern Virginia is very important in terms of the state's finances, we are a minority in terms of the number of people in the General Assembly. So we are always going to have that battle. But I think the efforts over the last year to make very clear that, you know, this conversation about Metro is just not a not an intellectual one. It's a real one.
Let me ask you about the transit union. The ATU put out its own plan. It said no cuts, no employee raises, said everything. You just described yourself as a progressive. Many people are saying, doesn't Trump say that all the time? Many people are saying, well, I'm going to change that phrase.
Yeah, right.
I heard, and no. Where does the union fit? It's got a very good deal, people think, but it takes management and union to agree on things. The union says, don't cut our salaries, don't cut our staff, don't lay it on the workers. We need to, you know, raise taxes, fix other things, but don't tack us.
You know, this plan envisions not only that the union remains, but that there will be continued growth in wages. You know, the 3% jurisdictional increase essentially implies that we expect that over time we will be able to raise living standards for employees. That's a key consideration for me. However, that rise in living standards is going to be tied to fiscal reality. And Metro has not in its history ever really had that nexus where the capacity to actually pay for things was tied to the agreements that were made with workers. And that's just not sustainable. You know, I am not interested in seeing that Metro you know, erode good quality jobs. But at the same time, those jobs have to become, those jobs have to have growth in their wages based on reality.
And what about arbitration, which is the lifeblood for the union? Every time it has a battle with management, it seems to get an arbitrator to agree with the union.
That's right. And this plan actually helps with that because, you know, part of it calls for requiring through federal law that they change the arbitration rules. But even without that, you know, the 3% cap in subsidies, the dedicated financing, creates a very clear picture of Metro's financial ability. And that will have to be viewed by an arbitrator. And I think that will make the awards fair.
Our guest is Christian Dorsey. He's an Arlington County board member and a Metro board member. You can address your questions to him at 800-433-8850. Here is Ed in Arlington, Virginia. Ed, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. This is for Mr. Dorsey. I'm an Arlington resident. How come we're so quick to consider raising taxes here? Couldn't we explore other avenues to avoid that, such as granting concessions to people to sell coffee and snacks or
more advertising on Metro?
Management.
Yeah.
Excuse me, outsourcing the operations to a private company.
You know, Ed, those are great points, and those are all part of what this plan that was recently released intends to do, to take a look at how, you know, Metro stations, Metro properties could use a concession model that you more commonly see at airports, that we look at ways to, you know, privatize where it makes sense and where it is appropriate. You know, certain segments of the operations. That's part of the whole cost containment plan. But I will say, Ed, and it hurts me to tell you this as a constituent, because I would love to always be able to say we're going to deliver more service and you're not going to have to pay a dime more. But the reality is that for, you know, the 40 years of Metro's existence, you know, preparing for doing all of the work to keep it in a state of good repair was not done. And the bill falls on us, and the responsibility falls on us, and that unfortunately includes, on some level, needing to increase taxes to do it. My job is to make sure that is as fair and as reasonable and as sustainable as it can be.
Thank you very much for your call, Ed. Arlington is only a piece of the puzzle. Recently, D.C.'s mayor took the governors of Maryland and Virginia to task for creating a new panel, in the case of Virginia and in the case of Maryland, agreeing with it, a new panel to study Metro, rather than going about the business of finding more money for the system. What's up with that? Is there yet another study needed? Has Metro been studied enough?
I have study fatigue, Kojo. I really do. Because each of these studies confirm the same thing. And, you know, when you got everything confirming the same thing, can we just accept that this is the state that we're in?
Was this the Governor McAuliffe's way of just pushing this off to the next governor?
You know, I'm gonna take Governor McAuliffe. I'm going to not view it as a negative response, but really as an effort to get the General Assembly on board. Someone like Ray LaHood is someone who's got great credibility.
Former Transportation Secretary.
That's right. Someone who is a Republican, but who is known for his bipartisan coalition building, worked in the Obama administration. He brings a sense of credibility that maybe perhaps some of these other efforts have never had. So I view this as the governor's way of not kicking the can down the road, but finally maybe bringing a voice to the table who can get people to listen.
We got a tweet from MV Whale. Mr. Dorsey, how will the new tolls on 66 benefit the localities through which the road goes?
So it's a great question. You know, the expansion of 66 is not something that I personally supported, but it is what it is. The state had the authority to do it, and it's doing it. With that comes a commitment, an agreement to provide an infusion of capital. It's going to start at about $15 million a year in toll revenue, which the jurisdictions can use for multimodal improvements. And what Arlington is focused on, and I can say the same for Alexandria, Fairfax, are finding ways to move more people through the 66 corridor and not relying on cars so that we can actually enhance transit capacity. So the silver lining in that overall, what I think, wrong decision to widen 66 is that there is money for those improvements.
You and your colleagues this week agreed on a real estate tax increase of 1 cent, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's really 1 cent per $100 of assessed value. And news reports say that it means the owner of a typical Arlington home will have to pony up an additional $300 a year. What will this mean for Arlington's coffers, and how will it go over with homeowners who are already being hit with higher assessments?
Well, can I just add that typical homeowner being cited there is a $700,000 house.
I see.
And 1 cent raises $7 million a year.
Yeah, that's right. And a slight correction.
1 cent.
Slight correction. We're looking at about a 1.5 cents increase.
Correct.
That's our latest markup. And it's not just because of Metro, but it's also because we have an issue with a very rapidly growing school enrollment circumstance. So, look, nobody likes to pay more, but I think our constituents, our community generally agrees and understands that we're well managed and that the needs of Metro and schools cannot be ignored. And while we would like to pay the same, we realize that occasionally we have to pay more. And I have to point out that last year we cut the tax rate by half a penny. So, you know, we in Arlington respond to the needs as they are presented, and I think most people will understand.
I went back and read, listened to your speech in January at the beginning of the session.
Well, you do research.
I try to.
Wow.
I do, but I want to ask you, can I ask him about Reevesland?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Reevesland is a 2.5-acre former dairy, open space land near 4 Mile Run area. And the candidate, Mr. Dorsey, was in favor of Arlington keeping it public land. More recently, he has voted to maybe sell this land.
Board member, Mr. Dorsey,
board member.
Have a different view.
So, you know, this is the politics hour, I might add. So, you know how your Arlington folks feel about land and
yeah.
open space and recreation and healthy living? Where are you now? I'm told that this vote might be reversed and that you guys might decide to keep it or do something to help people raise the money to keep it.
You know,
and
my,
I realize a lot of people out in Maryland and other places don't know where this is, but in that community, those 2.5 acres mean something in that building.
Absolutely. And I will say there's two issues there. There's the land surrounding the building, which is going to remain public. And that's something that we've absolutely done. The question is about the house, a deteriorated 19th century farmhouse. And the cost to make it available for public use exceeds our capacity to really responsibly commit to. It's over $2 million. Now, the question becomes, do we let the house just fall apart into disrepair, or do we find some good use for it? The option that we're pursuing now is to make it available for a private home, which wouldn't have a bad impact on the community, One of the things that I'm trying to explore is maybe if there are partnerships with Habitat for Humanity or the like, where if it is going to be a private residence, then maybe it could be made available for someone of moderate income as a home ownership opportunity. So there's a little bit more work to be done, but in terms of the public parkland, none of that is being taken away. And really, the question is, how do we not let the house fall down, but be used for something useful?
Almost out of time, but we got an email from Mark in Arlington. Recently, Arlington County's Transportation Department went through a public process to add bike lanes to Washington Boulevard. Despite public comments 2-1 in support of adding bike lanes, they're only adding them in one direction to maintain parking on the other side of the street for homeowners who already have driveways. This goes against Arlington's public support for cycling. Also, it appears that the Arlington Way is crumbling. Overwhelming public support loses to a few well-connected interests. What does Mr. Dorsey think, and is he willing to ask the county manager to revisit this? You have about 1 minute left.
Okay, very quickly. So, you know, this is just trying to create a balance so that, you know, public roads can serve a variety of purposes to make the road better for cyclists, adding bike lanes where there weren't any, but also recognizing that removing 150 parking spaces, not just in front of homes, but in front of, you know, businesses like daycares, is really not necessarily achieving our overall safety goals. So, you know, we're trying to split the baby here and trying to make improvements while at the same time not creating a side that loses entirely. So, you know, I understand that there are people who disagree with it, but I think it's a fairly responsible way forward.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Christian Dorsey is an Arlington County board member and a Metro board member. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Thank you, Tom.
That's it for the show today, but we want you to know that our conversations never stop online or on the street, which is why I'd like to see you next Thursday at the Bus Boys and Poets at 14th and V Streets Northwest. That evening, I'll be interviewing American University professor Derek Hira about his new book, which explores neighborhood changes in the Shaw and the U Street neighborhoods. It's part of the WAMU book series, and our conversation at Bus Boys will be part of their event partnership with Politics and Prose. It's free and open to you. We'd like to see you there. You can find information about it at wamu.org/events, so come on out. And don't forget to meet us here on Monday at noon. We'll talk about a recent report showing the impact of income inequality on D.C. families. We'll also explore a controversial proposal to create safe spaces in Baltimore where opioid addicts would do drugs and get professional treatment. That's all from noon until 1 on Monday. In the meantime, Tom Sherwood, you're going out walking around the White House this weekend?
I'm going to find a sidewalk that doesn't have barriers on it.
I don't think you will be able to succeed in that endeavor this weekend. All the sidewalks
live free or die. Was that Vermont?
Precisely because they don't want Tom Sherwood hanging around. He's our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Have a great weekend, everyone. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schroepdorf, Ruth Tam, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Cliff Gallagher has been on the phones. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.